Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for May 1st. This is Wednesday. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Pam Rhodes and Patty Daniels. Here's our first story from the front page. I'm going to read Utility Board Member Removed. Written for us by Sarah Watson. Without public discourse by council members, the Eldridge City Council voted unanimously Monday to remove Paula Stewart from the city's utility board. Mayor Frank King sent letters in early April to Stewart and a second board member who later resigned, informing them they were removed from the board and were entitled to a hearing before the city council and a formal vote on their removal. Stewart is one of several utility board members the mayor and council have removed in recent months amid an ongoing rift between the city and the utility. In a special meeting Wednesday, the mayor read off charges against Stewart, which included allegations that she breached her fiduciary duty as a trustee, approved employee raises outside of the collective bargaining agreement. King said the raise resulted in Stewart's son receiving a wage increase four times the percentage in the collective bargaining agreement. Failed or refused to review receipts or invoices for utility fund expenditures. Failed or refused to address alleged misconduct and insubordination by the utility manager and utility clerk. And it continues. A utility employee hired a law firm and began working with them prior to authorization by the utility board, but at the cost of the utility board. King said thousands of dollars in costs had been incurred. Attorney Mike Maley, who represents the utility clerk placed on leave pending a city investigation, questioned the council on what the city was accusing Stewart of doing. Malloy noted that the city's charges against Stewart did not include dates, times, or a basic set of facts. Any public official, including yourselves, if you were charged with a crime, you'd want to know what the hell you're being charged for, Malloy said. What the date was, what the time was, what information, factual information, supported the charge. If you read all these charges, they throw the proverbial kitchen sink at Ms. Stewart here. None of these charges have any specifications to them. Nothing concerning time, date, place, the who, what, when, where that any newspaper reporter would report. Stewart disputed that she or the utility board did anything improper. She said the board acted as a body and she did not take actions as an individual. She said the board authorized the bills payable report at February 6, February 26, and March 7th meetings and questioned whether city council members have asked to see individual invoices of the city. She said the city never provided proof of employee insubordination to the utility board, who, she said, the utility employees should be reporting to, and she nor other board members received proof of misconduct by utility employees. She also said the board was well aware that utility staff reached out to legal counsel and that the firm spent three and a half hours to ensure the firm would represent this utility before the board gave its official authorization. Stewart also laid out a timeline of events. She said disputes began with the utility board meeting February 6, where they debated a new handbook and organizational chart. The utility board and city disagreed on who the utility manager should report to, the city administrator or the utility board. It was decided that none of us were experts on the subject and that a mediator was needed. The council and utility board never met with a mediator. After that meeting, let's be frank, all hell broke loose, Stewart said. On February 15th, she said, Board Chair Brock Kroger was informed he would no longer serve on the utility board because he didn't live in the city. Kroger is suing over his removal, arguing there were no state or city codes setting residency requirements at the time. The city council then passed an ordinance codifying that only Eldridge residents could serve on city boards and commissions. On March 4th, Craig Gerls and Jeff Hamilton were appointed to the utility board, Stewart said. The city sent a FOIA request to the utility board the next day. Later that month, the city placed the utility manager and utility clerk on administrative leave March 25th, Stewart said. On March 26th, Stewart said the mayor invited all board members to individual meetings. On March 27th, she said, another board member, Jim Skidall, received a notice that he was removed prior to a utility board meeting. She said King threatened that if the utility board proceeded with their meeting, there would be legal implications. On the agenda were items to reinstate the utility manager and clerk, Stewart said, as well as to establish a separate employee identification number for the utility direct staff to establish vendor accounts and legal district counsel to engage with the city regarding the employees placed on administrative leave and authorize the legal firm to obtain quotes for an independent investigation of city allegations. Craig and Jeff had been on the board for maybe 10 days when the mayor came in and threatened us. They completely shut down, Stewart said. The only filing thing we got past that day, everything else was tabled, was to authorize legal counsel to obtain quotes for an investigation of our own. The council then met with less than 24 hours' notice to remove Skidall from the board because, according to the agenda, Skidall refused to meet with King. On March 28th, Stewart said she had a meeting with the mayor, city administrator, and council member Ryan Fossey, which she left feeling as if we were in a better place. On April 1st, the utility boards held a special meeting and unanimously voted to hire JL Consulting to do an independent investigation of the city's allegations against the two utility employees. That's when she and Barb O'Brien received their letters of removal, Stewart said. After public comment in which a few audience members spoke in favor of Stewart, the city council went into executive session. When the council returned, without discussion, the members voted unanimously to remove Stewart.
Therapeutic riding. New Kingdom Trail Riders in Sherrod celebrates 40 years. This article is written by Gretchen Teske. For 40 years, one therapy program has cornered the Quad City market on connecting horses with humans. The New Kingdom Trail Riders, NKT, 18929 81st Street in Sherrod, is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. The nonprofit is dedicated to providing therapeutic horseback riding lessons to those in the community. In an average week, 110 riders come through the barn doors. The six-week sessions are open to people ages 4 and up, and interest has increased steadily over the years. Last year, NKT gave 3,600 lessons with the help of more than 150 volunteers who logged 9,500 hours of donated time. That is almost double where we were at 5 years ago, said Executive Director Kelly Kreiter Penning. A couple of the stalls at the front of the barn have been converted into office spaces for the four full-time staff members, and conference rooms were created out of the others. The adjacent walls are decorated with photos, awards, and certifications. NKT is certified by the Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship, otherwise known as PATH, P-A-T-H. Clients of NKT are typically facing physical, mental, social, or emotional challenges. We have been a PATH center for the entire 40 years, and this says that we're doing all the right things, Kreiter Penning said. This also means all our instructors are certified therapeutic riding instructors. The certification provides guidelines for how the horses are kept and cared for, in addition to rules for volunteers, the saddles, and facility. With this as a base, equine therapy can provide a plethora of benefits, Kreiter Penning said, including mental stimulation, physical strengthening, emotional development, and social interaction. What we do is adaptive riding, so our focus is on horsemanship and building horsemanship skills, she said. We do a full interview on every single rider. We talk to their caregivers. We set goals for them on what they want to do, and we create this entire inclusive therapeutic environment for them to excel. Kreiter Penning said she has personally seen this growth, not just for students with different abilities, but for those who are facing challenges in their day-to-day lives. It provides an alternative encouragement for our riders to find success and build self-esteem, she said. We have seen an increase in our riders that are dealing with bullying, depression, and anxiety, especially in our teens. When you can come to and be a part of something that's as loving and caring as every person you meet here, you can excel in that environment and go back out into the world more capable to handle life's challenges. The benefits, she said, do not just come to those who ride. Volunteers also see rewards. Kreiter Penning said she volunteered at various equine therapy nonprofits for the last 25 years before joining NKT a few years ago. She traded in her corporate job for the opportunity to go back to school for mental health counseling and now runs the program. We volunteer because we get to see and be involved in something that has a really strong mission, she said. NKT began in 1984, organized by a group of people who started in their backyard, Kreiter Penning said. NKT moved to Charond in 2014 and is the only PATH PATH certified facility in the area. Riders are mainly in Rock Island County, she said, but come from as far away as Monmouth, Geneseo, and Muscatine. In the barn, NKT works with a team of 13 horses, including Silver, Charlotte, Husker, and Dante. All their stalls are labeled with their names and a paper that lists their birthday, intake day, and a little about their personality. Kreiter Penning said during the interview process, they match each rider to a horse based on their abilities and goals, not on the size of the animal. Knowing that each animal's individual personality helps with the matching process to help the rider succeed. Above the nameplates on the stalls are small plaques honoring sponsors of the program, Kreiter Penning said. NKT is volunteer-based and donor-driven, with 75% of its funding coming from sponsorships and fundraising. The horses are either purchased with grant funds or donated by owners who support the mission and feel the horse has the right temperament for therapy, she said. They all go through a training process to ensure they are ready to work with students. One rider at NKT has been prone to having seizures while on their horse, Kreiter Penning said. The horse can sense the seizure coming and will stand still until the rider is ready to continue. They are very perceptive and are like mirrors to us. They tell us so much about what is happening with those riders that the riders usually can't tell us, but the horses give us the clues, she said. It's a really unique space. They get really connected to their horse. During lessons, riders work on a variety of activities depending on their goals. Some are working on the basics of riding, while others are working on cognitive skills by practicing executive functioning, a set of goals to complete a task. In the indoor area, volunteers set up a variety of obstacles and pieces to help the students execute their task. When the horses are not in line for lessons, they are free to roam on the 20 acres that border the facility, which also includes an outdoor arena. The horses are well compensated for their hard work, receiving chiropractic care, massages, and farrier work when needed. Parents as well receive therapy in the form of support, Kreider Penning said. A section of the arena is blocked off for parents to watch their children during lessons. In addition, many of the children are facing adversity of some kind, whether physical or mental, then take solace in being able to talk to each other. We have families that are connecting here that never would have met outside of here, Kreider Penning said. We see riders connecting with each other that also wouldn't have met outside here, but now they are friends and have this additional support group. To sustain the organization for the next 40 years, Kreider Penning believes staying focused on the mission and success for the riders will be key. Running a nonprofit is not easy work, but seeing how it transforms lives makes it all worth it. Every time we read a comment, we say, "That's the way. That's why we do what we do," she said. Everyone's heart is truly in the right place.
Thank you, Pam. There's a legislator review here. Croken criticizes agenda of GOP majority, written for us by Caleb McCullough. Ken Croken is a Democrat who resides in Davenport and represents House District 97. He is retired and was formerly a marketing and government relations chief for Genesis Health System. He is in his first term in the Iowa House and previously served on the Scott County Board of Supervisors. Croken said last year he was glad the legislature passed a bipartisan property tax reduction proposal. He is up for re-election in November, challenged by Republican Joshua Rodriguez. Area Education Agency overhaul. No. This is key votes from Mr. Croken. Income tax cut. Yes. Illegal immigration enforcement. No. Allowing school staff to carry guns. No. Postpartum Medicaid extension. No. Bill sponsored and worked on. House File 2293 raises the minimum Iowa wage to $14.10 by 2026. Successes of the session. Overall, I'm disappointed with the session. I think the failures to the people of Iowa vastly outnumbered the successes. It's kind of an old way of measuring success, but of the 40-plus anti-LGBTQ, or maybe stated in more generally, inclusiveness proposals, only a handful were ultimately signed into law. The disappointments from the session. I'm disappointed that the governor and the GOP majority's anti-public education agenda was advanced as far as it was. No issue of the past session prompted more outraged email than the dismantling of the area education agencies, and that was a great disappointment to me. Taken alone, it was a bad and misguided initiative of the governor and her GOP majority, but when considered in cooperation with all the other anti-public education alternatives, such as the private school voucher program, I think rather clearly paints a picture of an administration with little to no regard for the value of public education.
Congress mulls action on Boeing's safety record. Dueling Senate hearings recently focused on Boeing's safety culture with whistleblower testimony that lawmakers called troubling as they pledged to further address the company's problems. A Federal Aviation Administration-appointed panel addressing the U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation on April 17th described a culture at Boeing that needs to be substantially changed from its current environment, where employees fear retaliation if they bring up safety concerns. That hearing coincided with a hearing with the Senate Homeland Security Subcommittee, which heard accusations from current and former Boeing employees that the company hid safety risks. In response, Boeing has said its 777 and 787 planes are safe and that retaliation is strictly prohibited. Congressional scrutiny has increased since the January incident on an Alaskan airline flight when a fuselage panel blew out a Boeing 737 MAX. Whether that scrutiny will drive changes in Washington, D.C. remains an open question. The Ontario, California-bound flight from Portland was at 16,000 feet when the fuselage piece called a door plug blew out and passenger cabin decompressed. Alaska and other airlines temporarily grounded dozens of MAX 9s, and the FAA ordered Boeing to postpone its planned production ramp-up pending extensive audit of the company's manufacturing and quality systems. A National Transportation Safety Board investigation found that four bolts that should have kept the door plug in place were missing. The door plug had been opened at the Renton factory so a team of supplier Spirit AeroSystems could repair damaged rivets next to the door plug, according to the NTSB. Boeing has until late May to come up with a plan to fix its quality control problems, as required by a deadline set by the Federal Aviation Administration in February. Meanwhile, Congress is nearing its May 10th deadline for the long-term reauthorization of the FAA, which has faced criticism for its often cozy relationship with Boeing. Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat from Washington, who chairs the committee, Commerce Committee, said last week she wants to go beyond the FAA reauthorization bill in drafting legislation related to aviation safety. Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, the Democrat who chairs the Homeland Security Investigation Subcommittee, is seeking testimony from the outgoing Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun and pushing Boeing to respond to requests for information and documents, the senator's office said. Blumenthal and subcommittee ranking member Senator Ron Johnson, Republican Wisconsin, had summoned Calhoun for its April 17 hearing, though Calhoun didn't attend, nor did any Boeing executives. "We want to provide Boeing the opportunity to explain to the American people why, in the light of recent apparent safety failures, the public should feel confident in Boeing's engineering and assembly processes," the two lawmakers wrote in a March 19 letter to Calhoun. "We expect Boeing's full cooperation with our inquiry and look forward to this testimony," Blumenthal said in a statement.
Thank you, Pam. We'll do some local news now. Man wounded in Rock Island shooting. A Sunday afternoon shooting in Rock Island left a man seriously wounded, though police do not believe his injuries are life-threatening. Officers responded around 3:15 p.m. to multiple complaints of gunfire around the 1100 block of 8th Avenue, according to the Rock Island Police Department. When the officers arrived, they found the wounded 20-year-old. Investigators also found a stolen firearm in the immediate area, the department said. The shooting remained under investigation Tuesday. The Rock Island Police Department asks anyone with information about the shooting to contact its investigators at 309-732-2677 or the Quad Cities Chapter of Crime Stoppers at 309-762-9500. And I'm also going to read here. Powerball win draws attention to an immigrant culture. Written for us by Claire Rush and Jean Johnson of the Associated Press. Portland, Oregon. This is not local news, sorry. Portland, Oregon. Charlie Safan wore a broad smile and a bright blue sash emblazoned with the words, EOMEN USA, as he hoisted an oversized check for $1.3 billion above his head. The 40-year-old immigrant's luck in winning an enormous Powerball jackpot in Oregon, a lump sum payment of $422 million after taxes, which he and his wife will split with a friend, changed his life. It also raised awareness about Lumian people, a Southeast Asian ethnic group with origins in China, many of whose members fled from Laos to Thailand and then settled in the U.S. after the Vietnam War. "I am born in Laos, but I am not Laotian," Safan told a news conference Monday at Oregon Lottery headquarters, where his identity as one of the jackpot's winners was revealed. "I am Lu Minh." During the Vietnam War, the CIA and U.S. military recruited Lu Minh in neighboring Laos, many of them subsistence farmers, to engage in guerrilla warfare and to provide intelligence and surveillance to disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail that the North Vietnamese used to send troops and weapons through Laos and Cambodia into South Vietnam. After the conflict, as well as the Laotian Civil War, when the U.S.-backed government of Laos fell in 1975, they fled by the thousands to avoid reprisals from the new communist government, escaping by foot through the jungle and then across the Mekong River into Thailand, according to a history posted on the website of Lu Minh's Community Services in Sacramento. More than 70% of the Lu Minh population in Laos left, and many wound up in refugee camps in Thailand. Thousands of the refugees were allowed to come to the U.S., with the first waves arriving in the late 1970s, and most settling along the West Coast. The culture had rich traditions of storytelling, basketry, embroidery, and jewelry making, but many initially had difficulty adjusting to Western life due to cultural and language differences, as well as a lack of formal education.
Walmart to close health centers. Walmart will close its health centers and virtual care service after struggling to find success with the offerings, the U.S. retailer said Tuesday. The Bentonville, Arkansas-based company said that after managing the clinics it launched in 2019 and expanding its telehealth program, it concluded, "There is not a sustainable business model for us to continue." Walmart had 51 health centers in 5 states with the goal of helping people save money on their health care needs. "This is a difficult decision, and like others, the challenging reimbursement environment and escalating operating costs create a lack of profitability that makes the care business unsustainable for us at this time," the company said in a statement. A spokesman said reimbursement proved challenging from all types of insurance. The planned closure of the Walmart health centers comes after the company announced on March 2023 that it planned to add more than 2,000 health centers to some of its stores this year. At the time, the company said it was looking to open 28 centers in 2024, mostly in Dallas and Houston. It also planned to expand into Phoenix and Kansas City, Missouri areas. Walmart is among several retailers that sought to build a presence with medical clinics and make healthcare more accessible, but some struggled. Walgreens spent more than $5 billion a few years ago to acquire a majority stake in VillageMD and planned to add hundreds of clinics to its stores. In late March, the company announced the closure of 140 of its VillageMD primary care clinics and plans to shutter 20 more to boost profitability. The announcement came after Walgreens recorded a $5.8 billion after-tax impairment charge for VillageMD in its most recent quarter as it adjusted the asset's value. Though the United States has a shortage of primary care doctors, building a network of primary care clinics can be challenging, even for established companies, according to health care researchers and analysis. Many people who already have a doctor may be reluctant to leave, and some may not want to get care in a store or retail setting. Clinics also may have to spend a lot of money to treat and improve the health of new patients who haven't been seeing a doctor.
Thank you, Pam. We'll move on to the obituaries next. I'm going to read the pendings first. Thomas L. Hansen, 76, of Cambridge, died Friday, April 26, at Hammond Henry Hospital, Geneseo. Cremation rites will be accorded. Private family interment will be in the National Cemetery on Rock Island, Arsenal. Memorials may be made to the charity of the donor's choice. Stackhouse Moore Funeral and Cremation Services, Cambridge, is assisting the family. Ellen M. Hobart, 81, of Moline, passed away April 29th at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House. Arrangements are pending at Esterdahl Mortuary and Crematory, Limited in Moline. Jeffrey D. Couts, 62, of Moline, passed away Monday, April 29th at his home. Arrangements are pending at Rafferty Funeral Home, Moline. John R. Lee, 57, Milan, Illinois, passed away Monday, April 29th at Unity Point Trinity Hospital, Rock Island. Arrangements at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory in Milan. Beverly M. Meyer, 86, of New Liberty, Iowa, passed away Tuesday, April 30th at Genesis East Medical Center in Davenport. Arrangements are pending at Bentley Funeral Home, Wilton, Iowa. Dolores F. Mulville, 93, of Davenport, passed away Monday, April 29th at Call Home, Davenport. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and Direct Burial of Moline. John Lyle Myers, Jr., 75, of Davenport, passed away Friday, April 26, at his residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and Direct Burial of Moline. Richard Gene Reed, 66, of Moline, passed away Friday, April 26, at his residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and Direct Burial of Moline. J.B. Riley, 84, of Davenport, passed away Sunday, April 28, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City. Arrangements are pending at Orr's Mortuary, Rock Island. And Gina L. Roet, 69, of Galesburg, passed away Wednesday, April 24th, at her residence. Cremation will be directed by Mississippi Valley Cremation and Direct Burial, Moline.
Catherine Peters, 87, of Eldridge, passed away Saturday, April 27th, at Clarissa C. Cook Hospice in Bettendorf. A memorial service will be Wednesday, May 1st, at 12 noon at the Rungi Mortuary. There is no visitation. Her final resting place will be in Davenport Memorial Park. Memorials may go to the family. Marilyn was born in Cedar Rapids, Iowa on February 4, 1937. She was the only child of Calvin and Treva M. Mosier. Growing up, she loved going with her parents to Iowa football and basketball games. Her parents owned cottages in Guttenberg, Iowa and Tomahawk, Wisconsin, and she always looked forward to spending time at both places in the summers. In later years, after having children of her own, she loved to take them to experience the same joy she enjoyed working in her flower beds, yard, and just being outdoors in general. She loved crafts, shopping, watching The Bachelor on Monday nights, along with Hallmark movies, especially Christmas time. Aunt Marilyn also loved listening to the 60s and 70s music on her transistor radio and spending time with her daughters and grandchildren. She worked as an office assistant for a period of time and then worked as a self-employed housekeeper for a couple of area businesses while also working in the cafeteria at Maquoketa Valley High School. Those left to honor her memory include her daughters, Kim, Tracy, April, grandchildren, Aaron, Sean, Paige, Chance, Lucas, Brittany, Brianna, and Hunter, and great-grandchildren Hayden, Cameron, Wade, Cooper, and baby girl Fullerton, due in July. The family would like to thank the staff at Genesis East ER, the neurology department, Dr. Matt Neal, and the loving, caring staff at Clarissa Cook for the wonderful care shown to Marilyn and her family. Your kindness will not be forgotten. Judith Judy A. Mayer, née Alquist, 78 of Rock Island, entered life eternal on Friday, April 26th at Unity Point Health Trinity, Rock Island. Visitation will be Friday, May 3rd at 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Whelan Pressey Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island, Illinois. Funeral services will be held on Saturday, May 4th at 11 a.m. at First Lutheran Church in Rock Island, with a visitation an hour beforehand. St. John's Lutheran Church in Rock Island will host a reception following the funeral. Judy was preceded in death by her parents, Gerald and Vivian Alquist. She is survived by her husband, Reverend Greg Mayer, her children, Christine and G. Allen, and her grandchildren, Conrad and Catherine. She is also survived by her sister, Janice, her brother-in-law, David, Jeffrey and Philip, and many nieces and nephews. The family asks that memorials be made to St. John's Lutheran Church or First Lutheran Church of Rock Island, or to one of the many charities and causes that she supported. Condolences may be shared with the family at www.WhelanPressey.com.
Suzanne Margaret Gannon. Suzanne Susie Margaret Clower Gannon, 87, formerly of Welton, Iowa, died peacefully, surrounded by family, on April 19th. She was residing at Parc Provence in Crèvecoeur, Illinois. I'm sorry, Missouri. Susie was born on August 6, 1936, in Davenport to Frank and Margaret Clower. She graduated high school from Immaculate Conception Academy, Davenport, and went to work for the family business, Clower's Cafe in DeWitt, where she first met a young Richard Dick Joseph Gadden. They married at St. Joseph Catholic Church in DeWitt on February 14, 1957. The couple resided near Welton on the Gannon family farm, where Dick was born. They raised their five children there, where Susie was a busy housewife, cooking meals for both the family and the farmers in the field. She was an active member of the Altar and Rosary Society at St. Anne Catholic Church, the Welton Fire Department Women's Club, and a 4-H Club volunteer. In 2000, Dick and Susie moved to Cedar Rapids. She treasured watching her grandchildren in their school and sports activities, as she had with her own children. Susie was a poll worker for many elections, volunteered as a patient ambassador at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, and enjoyed spending time on counted cross-stitch projects, playing sequence with the grandkids, and solving Sudoku puzzles. Susie is survived by her children, Julie of Fair Oaks, California, Barbara of Camden, Missouri, Mark McCullough of Cedar Rapids, and Jeffrey Gannon of Valley Park, Missouri. Grandchildren, Margaret and Anna, Rose, Matthew, Brian, and Maggie Elbin, Jocelyn and Garrett Gannon, Courtney Elkin, and Austin McCullough Weston, and Piper Gannon, and great-grandchildren Trevor and Braden Aben. She's also survived by her brother, Bob Clower of Flower Mound, Texas, brother-in-law Tom Gannon, sister-in-law Madonna Gannon, and many, nieces, and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband of nearly 50 years, her parents and in-laws, Jim Gannon, Mary and Leonard Massey, John and Jean Gannon, and Rita and Ray Enters. The family will receive friends at a visitation on Friday, May 3rd, from 9 to 11 a.m. at St. Joseph Catholic Church, DeWitt, followed by a funeral mass at 11 a.m. in the church. Burial will be at St. Joseph Cemetery, DeWitt. All are invited to lunch afterwards at Buzzy's in Welton. Memorials are suggested to Siteman Cancer Center Advancement Office, St. Louis, Missouri. And that is siteman.wustl.edu. Arrangements are in care of the Schultz Funeral Home, DeWitt. Condolences may be expressed at schultzfuneralhomes.com. Carol L. Scharf. Carol L. Scharf, 83, of LeClaire, passed away peacefully on Monday, April 29, at the Call Home, Davenport. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 2nd, at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home, Bettendorf. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday morning at the funeral home. Burial will be at Glendale Cemetery, LeClaire. Memorials may be directed to the family. Carol was born July 3, 1940, in LeClaire to James and Geraldine Kahn Kipper in 1958. She graduated from LeClaire High School. In 1958, she graduated from LeClaire High School. She worked at the Bettendorf Public Library for 10 years before her retirement. Carol was a former board trustee at Bettendorf Optimist Club and past president of CODI PTA. Those left to honor her memory are her children, Connie Scharf and Alton, Lisa Scharf, three grandchildren, Stephen Humphrey, Mason Scharf, and Brooklyn Scharf, and siblings Pat Fisher, Kathy Gim, Vaughn Kipper, and Bill Kipper. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her daughter, Tammy Jo Scharf, and siblings Richard Kipper, James Kipper Jr., Jan Kipper, Gail Jackson, and Kurt Kipper. Online condolences may be shared with the family at McGinnisChambers.com.
Turning now to the obituary page, here's a letter to the editor asking editors if they want to pander to Fox News crowd. And this letter is written by Dennis Olson of Long Grove. I write in response to Fred Rudy's letter printed in the April 28th edition. The letter stated that this publication is so, quote, left-leaning, end quote, that it will lose subscribers. Specifically, the writer took issue with the Times printing a front-page story about the Arizona fake electors conspiracy case. He went on to say that this had already been litigated. Really? If so, these litigants would have been convicted long ago. Right-leaning news media and even right-leaning judges can't change the facts. Election fraud and interference is against the law. I defend the editor's decision to print this news simply because it's their responsibility as news reporters. When a paper buries important stories on page 5 or 6, they are doing our democracy a disservice. Unfortunately, this does happen too often. When it comes to the editorial page, apparently those who claim left-leaning aren't reading it. For too long, the op-eds and editorial cartoons pander to the far right. I say pander because either these are chosen to appease the right wing or the editors receive their journalism degree from Trump University. The answer is likely the former of the two. So I'll end with a question for the editors. Do you want to pander to the Fox News crowd, or do you want to serve the public as journalists writing hard news? Here's one more letter. This letter is from Richard Cherwitz, the University of Texas at Austin, who incidentally grew up in Davenport. Amazed voters don't care if Trump is guilty of crimes. This week, I closely monitored college campus protests, the New York hush money case against Donald Trump, the arguments made before the Supreme Court about presidential immunity, the comments of Republican leaders, and the newest presidential preference polls. As I watched with distaste most of the Sunday morning news shows, this compels me to worry that even if the verdict of legal cases against Trump are rendered prior to November, those outcomes won't impact the 2024 presidential election. Sadly, I am amazed that so many voters don't care about whether Trump committed crimes. Moreover, despite Biden's record of accomplishments, too many are willing to vote for someone admitting he will use the office of the presidency as a tool for revenge and who will undermine democracy and the rule of law. As a Jew, I am deeply disturbed by the not-so-coincidental rise of anti-Semitism. Frankly, I remain perplexed by the possibility that the majority of Americans are poised to vote against the only candidate who is a decent human being who cares more about his country and its citizens than himself. Never in my 72 years have I experienced such trepidation about the state of our nation.
A planetary tale about Earth. It so happened that the planets of the Milky Way galaxy organized to promote the common good of all the planets and of the billions of species that have evolved or been created on them. Among the services offered was an interplanetary health commission, which virtually monitored the health of the member planets. The commission observed that there was a fever developing on planet Earth, so they visited Earth to determine what measures might be needed to restore the health of the planet. They found that there was an imbalance in the various species that inhabited the planet, and this seemed to cause an unhealthy atmosphere for all species. There was one species in particular that was exploding in numbers and dominating the use of planetary land and resources. This was causing extremely damaging storms and extinction of many species due to the rise of planetary temperature and widespread pollution, unsustainable dangers to all of Earth's species. What to do about it? The commission observed some efforts by various concerned earthlings to remedy the unhealthy condition, but those who governed the nation seemed uninterested. The wealthiest earthlings claimed that such efforts would cut their profits, and they, the wealthy, controlled Earth governments, so nothing serious was being accomplished. If you were on the Interplanetary Health Commission, what would you recommend? Would you back up your recommendations with appropriate, enforceable law? What would you do about those earthlings who persisted in practices unhealthy for the planet and its species? And one more by Dennis Olson of Long Grove, asking editors if they want to pander to Fox News crowd. I write in response to Fred Rudy's letter printed in the April 28th edition. The letter stated that this publication is so left-leaning that it will lose subscribers. Specifically, the writer took issue with the Times printing a front-page story about the Arizona fake electors conspiracy case. He went on to say that this had already been litigated. Really? If so, these litigants would have been convicted long ago. Right-leaning news media and even right-leaning judges can't change the facts. Election fraud and interference is against the law. I defend the editor's decision to print this news simply because it's their responsibility as news reporters. When a paper buries important stories on page 5 or 6, they are doing our democracy a disservice. Unfortunately, this does happen too often. When it comes to the editorial page, apparently those who claim left-leaning just aren't reading it. Far too often, the op-eds and the editorial cartoons pander to the far right. I say pander because either these are chosen to appease the right wing, or the editors receive their journalism degrees from Trump University. The answer is likely the former of the two. So, I'll end with a question for the editors. Do you want to pander to the Fox News crowd, or do you want to serve the public as journalists writing hard news? Again, that's from Dennis Olson of Long Grove.
Turning now to the sports section of the paper, the Quad City Times. Bulldog surging late in the year. Bettendorf edged number 2 Dowling Catholic on Saturday. Bettendorf boys soccer head coach Ben Pennington was proud of his Bulldogs on Saturday afternoon after defeating the second-ranked team in the state. The ninth-ranked Bulldogs prevailed 11-2 Dowling Catholic in a penalty kick shootout in Iowa City. "That's a quality win," Pennington said. "My players were highly motivated because they, Dowling, are one of the best teams in the entire Des Moines metro area." Dowling senior goalkeeper Hudson Porter and Bettendorf sophomore goalkeeper Peyton Douglas combined for 11 saves. Douglas kept the Maroons off the score sheet to preserve the shutout. "You feel for the kids who missed the shots, but Peyton made 3 straight saves in the shootout," Pennington said. For the Bulldogs, who are 11-2 and 5-0 in the MAC, it was the 12th time in 13 games that they held their opponent to 2 goals or less. "Well, we moved our defensive middle fielder, junior Isaiah Gutten, as a center back, and we have another sophomore who is also very fast. We like to rotate the outside defenders, and it's worked," Pennington explained. "It's very hard to get through our defense." Bettendorf's only losses this season are against Dallas center Grimes, who is 9-3, and West Des Moines Valley, who is also 9-3. A 1-0 setback in the second game Saturday in Iowa City. "We played Cedar Rapids Kennedy and had a good win, and then turned around 25 minutes later and played a team that got off the bus fresh," Pennington said about the loss to Dallas center Grimes. "It's not an excuse, but a physical reality when we have played a great game. We were just out of gas for the Valley game, too. I have coached kids for 42 years, but that does not make me an expert. I realize sometimes it would be nice to just get off the bus and play one game and go home." The Bulldogs are unbeaten at home, posting a 6-0 mark at Tuvel Stadium, with 2 home games left on the schedule against Southeast Polk, who is 7-4, on Friday, followed with a regular season finale on Thursday, May 9th, against Davenport North, who is 6-2 and 5-0. Davenport North head coach David Gamble was my assistant for 9 years, and the Southeast Polk game is part of a life is bigger than sports game that is center-based, that is cancer-based, and we all support it, Pennington said of the upcoming matches. "This is always a very moving weekend for teams. The game against North will be at home, and they could come for a conference title. Bettendorf is looking to pick up the page offensively. The Bulldogs have scored more than 1 goal just once over the past 4 games, but the other side deserves the credit," according to the head coach. "Just stick with the end game plan," Pennington said. "We need to be more confident. We have missed some shots that were very, very close. We have had low scores against stronger competition, and that is a credit to other schools. It's a game of soccer. It's hard to score goals. There's no shame in winning 1-0, and we have won 2 state titles that way, 1-0 and 3-0. London Potts led the Bulldogs with 14 goals and 11 assists. Chase Wakefield had 10 goals and Greeton 9. Before facing Southeast Polk on Friday, the Bulldogs traveled to Muscatine to face the Muskies, who were 5-3 and 4-2, at 6:30 p.m. Thursday. "Muscatine will be a tough game," Pennington said. "Muscatine always plays tough, and they always have quality kids. We love playing on their grass field."
Thank you, Pam. From the NFL Notebook. Overall ratings are down for draft. From the Associated Press, New York, after posting strong numbers for the first round, viewership for the NFL draft was down 3% from last year on TV and digital platforms. The draft averaged 5.74 million viewers for the 3 days this year across ABC, ESPN, ESPN2, and NFL Network after averaging 5.93 million in 2023, according to the league and Nielsen. The first round, where six quarterbacks were selected, averaged 12.1 million viewers, a 6% increase over last year. It was the highest day one viewership since it was the highest day one viewership since 2021, when there was an average audience of 12.6 million. The league and Nielsen said 53.6 million tuned in at some point over the 3 days to watch the draft festivities from Detroit. And the Jaguars cut Zay Jones, Jacksonville, Florida. The Jacksonville Jaguars released veteran receiver Zay Jones on Tuesday, 5 days after drafting LSU's Brian Thomas Jr. with the 23rd overall pick, and a day after agreeing to bring five-time Pro Bowler Jarvis Landry in for rookie minicamp. Jones was scheduled to count nearly $10.8 million against the salary cap in 2024. And lastly, Browns pick up Newsom option. The Cleveland Browns picked up the fifth-year option on cornerback Greg Newsom, Greg Newsom II's rookie contract. A first-round pick in 2021, Newsom is scheduled to make $13.3 million in 2025. Newsom has started to win. Has started 39 of 41 games in 3 seasons. The Browns also added depth to their offensive line, agreeing on a contract with free agent center Brian Allen. Allen started 36 games and a Super Bowl for the Rams before being released in February. And from The Wire, college basketball, St. John's pair suing NCAA. New York, St. John's basketball players Chris Ladlam and Jordan Dingle filed a lawsuit against the NCAA on Tuesday for denying their request for an eligibility waiver that would give them one more season of competition. The lawsuit in Queens, New York, Supreme Court, contends the NCAA unfairly denied the players their fifth years under the COVID-19 waiver granted to athletes whose 2019-20 seasons were disrupted by the pandemic. Ledlam transferred to St. John's from Harvard and Dingle from Penn before last season. Ledlam and Dingle also lost the 2020-21 season because the Ivy League opted to have no sports competition that academic year. That brings us to the end of Quad City Times for today. I'm Patty Daniels, and my partner at the microphone has been Pam Rhodes. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.